Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit SurreyFarms.com.
This is Chef Emily Peterson, host of Sharp and Hot. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to the main course. I'm your host, Patrick Martins. We're broadcasting out of Roberta's restaurant. We are very, very excited here at the Heritage Radio Network about the news section of the site, which has really transformed the way people interface with the radio. First and foremost, the news is the best way to hear a lot of the hosts. It's the hosts talking 2 to 3 minutes on a subject that they're an expert on. And we are cutting to really important news issues and showing how food is a component of those news issues. So we have a whole fantastic array, an army of interns that work with Aaron and Jack and Allison. And we canvass them to compile questions, kind of like training, like in the line of fire. We're like Joe Carroll, the head, the owner, the head, the visionary behind three of Brooklyn's most historic and important and well-liked restaurants, Fête Sau, St. Anselm, and more of a bar, Spooten Dival. So we're very excited, and they wrote up a bunch of questions. So welcome, and thanks for taking on this kind of rapid-fire news segment.
Yeah, man, right on. Thanks for having me.
How are you, by the way? Everything good? Business good? Family good?
I'm well, yeah. Summer was great, as always, and looking forward to the fall. Things are well. Kids are in school and happy, generally.
Very nice. And have you made your first billion yet, or is that still
not quite yet?
Post-fall?
Yeah, that's hopefully by 2015.
Because, every time I look, those places are packed. Packed, packed, packed. And they've been around for a while, so it's nice to see good things get old or older, yeah. You know, and not just be a flash in the pan.
Spine's 11 years old now.
Wow.
Yeah.
So older than most people's kids and all that, you know, right. They were before they were married, you know.
Right.
A lot of interactions with those places over the years. In fact, I think I got sick in your bathroom a few times
cool.
When you first
right
opened.
On.
That's how much I drank. But, all right, so our first question, and these are in no particular order, just the way they were asked. Yvette Cabrera. Jack, am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yes.
Yvette Cabrera is a writing intern, and she asks Joe, as a male barbecue chef, how do you feel about gender roles of men using the grill and women in the kitchen?
You know, I have no specific feeling other than like I don't see there being any gender roles. In fact, at St. Anselm, which is a grill driven restaurant, our kitchen is 3/4 female. And I don't see any difference or problem or issue, or I think it's great. And I obviously there's nothing, you know, that one sex brings to cooking or grilling or barbecuing that the other couldn't bring to it. It's funny how, and I don't know why exactly it's happened this way, but it is funny how, at least domestically, you know, in households, it is split. Cooking is split along the gender line in that women generally run the kitchen and men generally run the grill outside. I have no idea why that's developed that way. In my house, it's like my dad doesn't cook a thing, yet he'll grill stuff. And not that like he's way into grilling. It's just that like if something's got to get grilled, my mom's like, hey, grill it. Yeah, I have no idea. Maybe women were inside cooking stuff while the men were cooking the proteins on the grill, so it was a double duty issue, or I have no idea. I don't know why it's developed that way. I really can't. Maybe it's something, some weird sexist thing from 50 years ago. I don't know. I'm not sure why. But I don't see there being a problem or a difference or it being really relevant, you know?
I like that idea about it being a location thing. Women maybe were with the
right.
Kids, and that's where that kitchen was, whereas
yeah.
The grill was outside. Do you think when you're looking for a grill master, you just happen to expect it to be a guy? Or
No, I really don't. I mean, I don't think twice about it. It's just, you know, I want somebody who's capable and can execute well and can run a kitchen properly. And I don't give a shit.
Well, thanks, you know? Yvette, for throwing him a real softball there with that first one. Good Lord, Jack, who did you guys hire? So let's see. Eliza Lore is a writing intern. Yeah, Eliza Lore. What are your thoughts on the barbecue sauce wars, Joe?
My thoughts on barbecue sauce, and this holds true for Fête de Sau, is I like a little bit of sauce on my barbecue sometimes, but generally speaking, I don't like any of my barbecue to come pre-sauced. I don't like to get it from a barbecue place with a sauce all over it already. My feeling is that when you overuse anything, and that could be true with any other spices or herbs in cooking, it doesn't have to be sauce. When you overuse it, you're hiding the flavor of what it is you're trying to cook in the dish. And I think most importantly with the meat that we're using at Fête, being all heritage breed animals and naturally raised animals, there's so much flavor in that meat. And we do a dry rub that is a seasoning, essentially. So I think between the flavor of that's inherent to the meat and the dry rub seasoning, mm-hmm. sauce is really, for the most part, unnecessary. A little bit for some heat in spice, or a little bit for a little sweetness to balance, or perhaps vinegar to break up the richness of the fat. I don't have a problem with that. But to overly use sauce and I think, unfortunately, there's a part of this country, and some of those people are in really barbecue-centric locations, and most aren't, though, that really believe barbecue is sauce. I mean, without mm-hmm. barbecue sauce, there is no barbecue. But I disagree.
Do you, well, let's see, that reminds me. Caitlin Pierce, an outreach coordinator for the Heritage Radio Network, asks, will your barbecue, Joe, ever really be considered legit from Southern barbecuers, since you're from New Jersey and cooking in Brooklyn?
Probably not.
Just for that?
Probably not, but, you know, that's got to be put in context, because, you know, people from Eastern Carolinas don't necessarily think people from Western North Carolina are legit either. You know what I mean? So there's always this infighting in barbecue. It's always existed. I actually think there's less of it now than probably ever before, because people have experienced really good barbecue outside of the, you know, the handful of meccas for barbecue in the country. It'd be nice to be considered legit. Nothing makes me happier and prouder to meet people from Texas or North Carolina or Memphis who grew up eating barbecue and eat at Fête and love it and think it's, you know, as good or better than anything they grew up eating. But ultimately, no. Bottom line, it's a protectionist thing, right? Like, mm-hmm. if you're from Texas or you're from Memphis, you are protecting your own thing. So to legitimize some other barbecue area that even is legitimate to begin with is tough, let alone to legitimize somebody from Jersey and New York City.
From the North.
I'm okay with it, by the way, though.
Yeah. Well, we won the war, so we're fine with it.
Right.
Eliza Lore, a writing intern for the Heritage Radio Network, asks, do you use Heinz ketchup? What do you think of Heinz? And name your top three sauces that you have in your refrigerator of all time, not homemade ones, like big company ones.
We do use Heinz at Fête for our sweet barbecue sauce as a base. At St. Anselm, we don't use Heinz for the hamburger, mostly because everything there is kind of a little more farm driven, it's a little more handmade, and but look, the reality of it is, and many people before me have said this, it's hard to beat Heinz, man. It really is. I mean, you could make very good tasting ketchup yourself, or somebody else can do it for you. But it's hard to replicate Heinz. There's so many little factors involved with what makes Heinz kind of great. I know early on at Whole Foods, they were very serious about not carrying any processed foods and all stuff, but the one thing they carried was Heinz ketchup, because how do you not, almost, you know? There's something about it. It's one of the few foods that's highly processed, that is kind of good. And well, at least it is exactly what you want and expect. Now, part of that might be every American grew up eating it. So it's so ingrained in, it's almost part of our DNA to know and like that specific flavor of ketchup, that maybe it's hard to go back on that. Mm-hmm. And as far as favorite sauce, I'm a huge fan of HP sauce. HP sauce, which is an English. Yeah, which I think is made by Heinz. For, I don't know, maybe not.
There's three or four flavors of that sauce. There's the regular one, then there's like a fruity one.
Yeah, I'm the OG fan, the original. Okay. Yeah, there's something great about, there's a bit of sweetness to it, but and umami even to it, but there's a fair amount of vinegar, a fair amount of acidity to it, and I think that is really important in almost any sauce. It needs that acidity to kind of lift everything and kind of, you know, drive the point of the flavor home. I like mustard a lot, and I'm not terribly particular about what kind of mustard. I like all kinds of mustard.
Grain mustard?
Dijon. Yeah, everything. You know, the funny thing is, though I like grain mustard, I tend to not be a huge fan of really almost pure grain mustard, where it's nothing but mustard seeds loosely held together. Because at that point, it's not really, it's like, it's hard to get it to coat anything. And it's true, you know, it's hard to spread it on bread, and you wind up using half the jar to cover a piece of bread. So not that there's any flavor issue with it, and I like the little crunch and pop from the seeds, but it's not the most practical, I think. I don't know, I'm probably forgetting a lot of little sauces I like, but you know, I like hot sauce too, and I like hot sauces that are, you know, the right level of heat. Something that lets you know that it's there, but nothing that gets in the way of flavor and like destroying your palate, basically. Mm-hmm. Big fan of Frank's Red Hot. I think it's like the perfect level of heat, you know? Mm-hmm. And again, it's really vinegar driven too.
I like hoisin a lot.
Sure.
I mean, I like the original sriracha, the real one, right. Not the one made in California. Right. Dijon, I always have. Heinz, horseradish, pure horseradish.
Yeah, I love horseradish.
Sauces are an interesting, much maligned, you know, I agree with you on Heinz. I think it is, you know, in fact, you know, I'll ask you next time, has St. Anselm broken and gone back to Heinz?
We use so little ketchup there that that it's not that big of a deal. You know, if we were using probably volume of ketchup, we would use Heinz.
So here we jump to, Jack, it looks like there's an angry vegetarian in the writing staff.
Oh, boy.
Amrita Gupta asks, do vegetarian vegans have feta sow, just eat a lot of sides?
Well, like, so here's the thing about that is if you are a vegetarian and especially vegan, why would you want to be a feta sow in the first place? Now, all right, I grant that sometime maybe you're one of like 6 or 8 people going out and everyone wants to go there and you kind of suck it up and go along. And in that case, I'm sorry. I feel bad for you. Our sides there, believe it or not, are all, except for the beans, our sides are vegan. I'm fairly certain in that there's no butter. We use olive oil and everything. And there's no other animal fat, no eggs, nothing like that. And any of our, like our potato salad is a German style potato salad. So there's no mayonnaise. The broccoli salad is very simply, you know, olive oil, lemon juice, garlic, and chili peppers. And, you know, sauerkraut and pickles, those things are all vegan, oddly enough. Not by design, just by the way it happened to be. But yeah, you know, why go to a barbecue place if you don't eat meat? And that holds true with St. Anselm, too. Why go to a place that focuses on, you know, steaks and chops and seafood and things like that? Now, again, we have a fair amount of vegetables at St. Anselm, and you know, a portion of those are vegan too, but not by design either. But not really the places, you know, look, there's plenty of places in New York City to go to eat predominantly. In fact, I'm just weeks away from opening a place with two partners, chefs, that is predominantly a vegetable driven menu. Though there will be a little tiny bit of protein on the menu, it's predominantly vegetables. So there's plenty of places in New York City's probably the easiest place in the country, or at least one of the top 3 places in the country to be vegetarian or vegan, because you have so many options. You know, tougher if you're in Peoria, Illinois, or, you know, somewhere in the middle of the country.
Would you recommend that people don't go to restaurants that bill themselves as vegetarian and seek out vegetarian options at the best restaurants that specialize partly in it?
For the most part, I think that's true. I think that the issue I have, not philosophically, but the issue I have with eating a lot of vegetarian and vegan food is that there seems to be a need to want to replicate meat all the time. I love vegetables and nuts and grains and non-meat things. But I love meat too. And I don't want to necessarily eat fake meat. Because most fake meat, A, doesn't taste like meat at all, even though a lot of vegetarians think it might. And also, like, why not embrace the point of being vegetarian or vegan and eat vegetables and grains and nuts and berries and things like that, and stay, like, why eat fake meat? What's the point? Just eat meat if you want that flavor and texture so badly. So I don't get that, and I've never really had any kind of fake meat meals that were good and well executed and really tasty. I've had plenty of vegetable dishes that were dynamite. So I think that's really what it comes down to. And usually if you're going to a more serious restaurant, they're not trying to fake meat. They're just trying to make great vegetables.
Well, this confirms that Amritra Gupta is a vegetarian, because now after asking the hardcore aggressive vegetarian question, she comes back with the meatiest of all the questions. Has anyone asked for grilled sweetbreads, ears, very unusual, awful cuts, and are there any limitations to meats that cannot be barbecued using the equipment of a big barbecue restaurant like yours?
We've done a ton of offal over the years at Fête de Sao. We've done calves' brains, and you know, we do tongue quite frequently. I don't know if tongue is necessarily considered offal, but we've even done heart. Though a lot of offal, either texturally or because of its fat content, or, you know, there's no real connective tissue in most offal, isn't best suited for the technique of barbecue for cooking. Generally, I'm a big fan of offal. The only offal I really don't like are kidneys. I've yet to have kidneys that didn't have a bit of urine flavor to them. Maybe not the biggest fan of tripe either, though I have had some tripe that's been pretty good. But I love brains. I love heart. Love liver in its all its form. We've definitely done some stuff, but like I said, barbecue isn't necessarily the best technique for cooking it.
I'm very interested. Every time I go to Paris, all the good bistros have kidney as a dish. It's surprising. If you go to Balthazar, there's definitely not a regular menu item for kidney.
No.
Or, you know, big places like that.
Most Americans still are a little squeamish. Even in this day of, you know, the foodie culture, most foodies, or, you know, self-proclaimed foodies, aren't really big fans of offal.
Did you say squeamish or peenish?
Squeamish.
It tastes like urine.
Squeamish. What an ass.
So Allison Hamlin is the deputy director of the Heritage Radio Network. And she asks, as long as a longtime pioneer of the Brooklyn restaurant and bar scene, but with an outpost in the works at the Bowery, what do you think of the hype about BK Brooklyn eclipsing Manhattan as the dining epicenter of New York?
Well, first of all, thanks to Eater, everyone seems to think we're opening a place in on the Bowery. And though we have been trying to do so, it's far from a definite thing, because there's a lot of issues that involve the space, and it could very well not happen. A year ago, Eater was at the community board hearing for the liquor license and printed that we were opening this place. So now, you know, a handful of times a week, I get asked, how's the project going on the Bowery? It's not going at the moment at all. I don't know that Brooklyn will eclipse Manhattan for fine dining, but that's not what Brooklyn was, the dining scene in Brooklyn was based on and what it's all about. In fact, just the opposite. Well, let me correct that. Not the opposite of fine dining, but certainly not the same fine dining. What has been so important in Brooklyn, in the dining scene, and really what has put Brooklyn on the map and what's been emulated across the globe now, is this idea of fine dining in a very casual setting, in a very unpretentious setting. You know, and being able to push the envelope a bit with menu and service and things like that, because you're not in Manhattan, because you're not paying $70,000 a month in rent, you're afforded an opportunity to experiment a little more and do things a little more off the beaten path. And that really has, I think, defined what Brooklyn dining is about. And in that sense, I think it has long surpassed where Manhattan is. I think as far as new interesting restaurants, Brooklyn has really surpassed that. I'm not sure if the Le Bernardins and Daniels and Percés of the city will ever open up in Brooklyn, or at least be the same thing. I mean, we have Brooklyn Fare and we have Blanca right here that are certainly doing the same level of food. I just don't know that the entire experience will be ever duplicated in Brooklyn, because it's not called for. It sort of isn't what Brooklyn is about. And you know, but who knows, you know, in 10, 15 years, Brooklyn might look very, very different than it does now.
Very interesting. Well, also from Allison Hamlin, and you've been very nice to answer these kind of rapid fire questions from the, and you know, much of the new team, many sure. of the new team people. She asks, Allison Hamlin, the deputy director of Heritage Radio Network, Sputin Dival open.
Spuiten Dival. So the U and the Y is pronounced like an I.
Partially on purpose. I mean, I literally.
You've been
just
saying that for 11 years.
No, so. Yeah, exactly. And I'm just like, I'm going with it. I abbreviate the Brooklyn Queens Expressway, the Bweeks, even though there's no we sign right. in it. And I don't know. But you know, you make your. It's like when you sure. remember a song.
Right. With the wrong lyrics.
Spuiten Dival.
Spuiten Dival.
Opened in 2003. What changes have you seen in the beer scene in the last decade?
Oh my God, so many. I mean, I've been involved in some way in the beer world since the very late 80s, early 90s. You know, originally just as a home brewer and a fan of beer, and then really until I opened Spuiten Dival, I wasn't involved in it professionally. And there were a lot of changes throughout the 90s that came, but in the last decade, and really the last maybe 7 or so years, God, the beer world has changed so much. I mean, generally for the better. I worry a little bit about the volume of beer that's being produced now and how long it can sustain the volume of craft beer. I have trouble keeping, I mean, this is what I do for a living, and I have trouble keeping up with it. Not just the amount of new breweries opening up at such a rapid pace, but the amount of new beers each brewery is producing. You know, it used to be most breweries made 4 to 7 beers a year, and that was it. Now that's like 4 to 7 beers a month, new beers.
But are these good beers? I know the brewing culture is very friendly to each other, and no one ever bashes beer. Can you be producing so many and just go from 2 beers to 30 and they all be great?
Well, I mean, you know, all be great? Probably not.
It's a question asked of other industries.
Right. Can you bat 1,000 all the time? Probably no. Doubtful. That said, there's been so much has happened in brewing and craft beer that all of the current newer, you know, the new wave of all these brewers are really, they're, you know, standing on the shoulders of giants, essentially. They're so much further ahead in their learning and their abilities and in their execution of brewing than anybody who came before them. So very quickly, they're able to produce really great stuff because they have, you know, a history now of craft brewing in this country and globally. So I think generally speaking, beer has never been better. There's no question. It's rare for me today to drink a beer that just outright sucks, a craft beer. I might have some that's okay, kind of boring, not terribly interesting, you know, decent. But rarely will I ever drink a craft beer that I think is bad, really poorly done. Not to say it doesn't happen. It does. It's
but just wines, you infrequent. Taste bad wines all the time.
Yeah, true. It's true, but I think this. I think that said, it still holds true with wine as well. There are still more wines being produced today of a high caliber than ever before. The majority of wine being produced around the world today is pretty damn good. It might not be amazing, but it doesn't suck for the most part. Even really cheap wine has gotten much, much better. So, you know, quality hasn't seemed to have been affected. Now, in the 90s, I don't think that was true. In the 90s, there were a lot of people getting into this without this history and experience to look back on and build upon. They were kind of creating it as they went along. And there were a lot of bad breweries and bad beers, and they've all, for the most part, since gone under as well. And, you know, I'm sure there'll be a bit of culling that takes place in the next handful of years with some of these breweries because, you know, New York City has gone from two or three breweries to 30-something, whatever it is now. I don't know the exact number, but it's a fair amount, you know, so quickly. Can everyone be supported? You know, new breweries come into the market all the time, and I'll meet with a lot of these brewers and brewery owners. They want my feedback as a buyer and you know, bar and restaurant owner in the market. And, you know, I tell them all now, don't come into this market with your flagship IPA or pale ale or wheat beer thinking you're going to kick ass in this market. It's not going to happen. Those days are gone. That window's shut. You walk into your average bodega now, there's 25 IPAs. So to come in new to the market, unless you're local and really can drive a kind of grassroots local effort, you're going to have a very difficult time. So, you know, I'll urge a lot of these guys, don't put your effort into your flagship brands from your home market. Come here with some oddball stuff. Come here with something else that people will take notice of. Otherwise, it's going to get lost.
Like a pumpkin beer.
Perhaps. Although now there's, you know, hundreds of pumpkin beers.
Jack, do you want to ask your question about pumpkin beers?
How much I hate them?
No, you had a question.
Yeah. I don't know if he has headphones on. But,
oh, yeah, put your headphones on there.
All right.
Talking into the mic here. Are pumpkin beers even a real thing?
Yeah, they're realer than most people think.
Well, aren't they made with, like, spices? And
well, yeah. So there's sort of two answers to your question. One is pumpkin beers are an historic beer. The second part of that question is the pumpkin beers that we drink today have nothing to do with those historic beers. Pumpkin beer, and not just pumpkins, gourds and vegetables in general, were used by and large to make beer in colonial America because there was very little grain grown here that was usable, barley in particular, to make beer with. And until that changed, until people were planting more barley, plus it wasn't necessarily the best environment and weather for a lot of barley to be produced, especially down south. So they used a lot of vegetables of different sorts as fermentable sugars and pumpkins and squash in general have a fair amount of sugar in them. And they actually produce a decent beer. It's certainly not the same as you would get from barley, but it's a historic fact that this was done. So there's this sort of basis of reality. And then what's happened is this is morphed into pumpkin pie beer. Everyone, you know, thinks of pumpkin and they immediately think of pumpkin spices as part of that flavor profile of pumpkin. Really, you know, pumpkin on its own tastes nothing like cinnamon and nutmeg. But when people think of pumpkin, they think of pumpkin pie and they think of those spices. And it's, you see it at Starbucks in their, you know, fall pumpkin coffee or whatever it might be. Everyone's emulating this cinnamon nutmeg thing. Whether it's because people realize that's kind of BS or because people are just trying to set themselves apart, there are more breweries now producing unspiced pumpkin beers, which are kind of cool. And they don't taste like pumpkin pie. In fact, in many cases, you don't necessarily even know there's pumpkin in them. But yeah, I get it. I'm not a big fan of that either. I'm not a big fan of heavily spiced beers in general. There are people who love it, absolutely love it, and like can't wait till the fall till these pumpkin beers get released. But you know, it's funny with all these seasonal beers and pumpkin beer in particular, because really in my mind, pumpkin beer is Oktoberfest and pumpkin beer. You got about a month window to really sell this stuff, and then it gets weird and it seems out of place. And these are things that I, as a bar owner, absolutely will not put on. I won't put Oktoberfest beers on until it's October. I'm not going to put them on in August. Yet now, because everyone's vying for the same shelf space and you know, production levels have to get sandwiched in because you're making 45 beers a year. Oktoberfest beer, pumpkin beer, gets released in late July, early August. It's a joke.
It's like, yeah, celebrating too early. That's why for the meat world, Goat-tober, Turk-vember, Duck-sember, you can't mess around with that. It's in the name of the month.
It's in the month. You can't, right.
Well, I would like to thank Joe Carroll for answering questions from Yvette Cabrera, Eliza Lohr, Caitlin Pierce, Amrita Gupta, I think I pronounced her first name three different times each time, Allison Hamlin, Jack Inslee. Joe Carroll is the owner of some institutional restaurants, Fetisau, Spite and Dival, and St. Anselm. Thanks, Joe.
My pleasure. Thank you, Patrick.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.